a member of our group who has been active in many of our programs, but who was instrumental in bringing our distinguished speaker to us here today, Professor Leo Levin of our law school.
Rav Soloveitchik, with the rabbis, friends. First, my thanks to Al Kutzik and to Bernie Steinberg, who made this rather glorious capping of a very active and fruitful year's programming possible. A wise man once said, "Let a teacher beware, for he knows not how far his influence extends." And there are some teachers, the lucky few, who occasionally touch a light here or touch a light there. And those whose lives have been touched may influence yet others. But all of us here know, students and teachers alike, that there really aren't many of these who have even that kind of privilege. But tonight, we have as our speaker a man who's recognized as the spiritual and intellectual mentor of the majority of Orthodox rabbis serving in this country today, who has touched directly and indirectly the lives of thousands, kindled in many a heart what the poet calls the inextinguishable fire. And he does so not simply because of his position at Yeshiva University and Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary. He does it not because of any kind of official position, but because of the quality of man. Holmes put it beautifully once when he said, "If a man is great, he makes others believe in greatness. He makes them incapable of mean ideals and easy self-satisfaction. It's the ferment of genius in its creative moment which inspires others." He gives rise, again to borrow from Holmes, the enthusiasm of the lecture room, the contagious interest of companionship, these things which make the students partners in their teacher's work, in the finest sense of that word. And who is this man, Rabbi Joseph Der Soloveitchik? Scion of Brisk, that famous family, who in 1930 was awarded the PhD in philosophy at the University of Berlin and a recognized authority in secular philosophy, himself a master of Talmudic scholarship, and one who's able to blend the wisdom of the one and the insights of the other. This teacher cannot be measured simply by the students in his classroom in the conventional sense, or even by those, the many, a surprising number, who each year choose to brave a Massachusetts summer to be with him in intensive study for the full period. But not even this suffices to give even a glimmering. His famous lectures, the Yahrzeit year, the pre-holiday lectures, when mature scholars, rabbis in pulpits from miles and miles around inform Balabatim flock, crowd the halls to listen and thereafter to discuss. And throughout all this period, in addition, he has served as chief rabbi of Boston, creator of institutions, leader of his flock. And yet when offered the post of chief rabbi of Israel some years ago, he made the choice that he preferred to spend his time primarily in the halls of learning, saying shiurim, touching the lives of others, I would say, in his role as teacher of a generation. And today, I say no more, for in a very literal sense, I think our tradition demands that someone far greater in stature than I could ever aspire to be would be required even to attempt assessment. But I think it is permissible to mention the topic. His topic today, the very formulation of it, he speaks a variety of disciplines and of culture. He speaks on prayer and redemption and halachic equations. We are privileged tonight to hear the Rav, as he is affectionately known, Rav Yosef Der Soloveitchik, Rabbi Soloveitchik.
Thank you very much, Dr. Let me reintroduce myself. I am not a philosopher. I am certainly not a theologian. I am a teacher. And I like teaching. To be teaching is not just a profession, but an experience. My field is a lot. I'm a teacher of Talmud, my field is a lot. I always believe that the halacha embraces a double order. An objective, abstract order. The halacha is very abstract. To study halacha means to learn how to concept the lines. So there cannot be any question of interpretation. The experience does not incorporate
the we are just concerned with correspondence. The experience corresponds to a certain halachic act. I'll try tonight, with your permission, to explore the experiential order of the within the halacha of prayer. What I'm going to say will not be philosophy. As I said, I'm not a philosopher. I would not engage in the philosophical jargon. Take my words, rather, as a confession rather than a discourse. I'll confide in you. I'll tell you the story of my prayer experience. If you should say that my feelings are sensible, that's all that I ask for, I'll feel proud. However, if you should dismiss them as neurotic, I won't feel offended. For it's an old, old doctrine. It is attributed to Plato, to Kierkegaard, but actually Maimonides said it in a more beautiful way. The religious experience is madness. Since I consider myself a religious person, so I'm mad. So if you'll dismiss them as being neurotic, I will not feel offended or insulted. Now, with your permission, I'll start with redemption. Gula is a fundamental category in Judaic thinking. Our history, as a matter of fact, was initiated by a divine act of redemption. We just celebrated the holiday of Passover. It's a holiday of redemption. And our history will also be consummated with the divine act of final, ultimate redemption, the so-called Gula Atida, the messianic redemption. The halacha, in a very strange, almost enigmatic manner, has identified redemption with prayer. To pray means to redeem oneself. To redeem oneself means to pray, because an equation can be reversed. And that equation of redemption and prayer was, so to say, subsumed under the famous halacha. I don't know you gentlemen, but many among you probably will know the term smicha zgula l'tfila. Zgula and tfila are identical. And it is our custom that in the morning we say Goal Yisrael, the Redeemer of Israel, and we start the Shem Nesrim, which is the tfila, the prayer, immediately. We don't even answer Amen, there is no Kaddish, but it's continuation. The Birkat Gula, I mean the benediction of Gula, is continued by the first benediction in Shem Nesrim. It's exactly what I'm going to explore. What is redemption? And I wish to remark, I'll employ the so-called Spinoza or Descartes method, more geometrical. I'll try to somehow to apply a mathematical approach to what I'm going to say. In the sense that I'll postulate a few premises. So it means it's more a deductive approach to the problem of prayer and redemption. Redemption portrays a shift from the periphery to the center of history, or employing the physical term, we may say redemption can be described as the centripetal movement from the periphery toward the center. Let me explain it. Being on the periphery, actually, means being a non-history-making collective or group. There are many groups which are on the periphery. They've never moved toward the center. Not only groups, even nations. Being on the periphery means to be a non-history-making collective. While the movement toward the center changes the same collective into a history-making, history-involved, and history-conscious. Not a collective anymore, but a people. A history-making people leads, it's very hard, I mean, to use an experiment, a speaking, storytelling, charismatic existence. An existence with a message, charisma. While a non-history-making, non-history-involved, a non-history-conscious people, group rather, I shouldn't say people, group is a non-communing, a non-communicative, a silent entity. History is history-making existence and a speaking existence are identical concepts. Now the answer to the question which I raised before, what is redemption, is obvious. Redemption is identical with the revelation of the word. When the word is revealed to a people, the people is redeemed. Or it is identical with the burgeoning of speech. When a people leaves a mute world and enters a world of sound, a world of speech, a world of song, the process of Geula, of redemption, commences. In other words, a mute life, a silent life, is identical with bondage, with slavery. A speech endowed life, a charismatic and a communicative life, is a free life. The slave lives in silence, if he does live at all. If he does live at all. The free man has a lot to tell. When he's ready to tell his story of his life to anyone who cares to listen. Free man has indeed a message to put across. The slave has no message, has no story. He is silent. The slave lacks the capacity not only of speaking, as a matter of fact, but of noise making or sound emitting as well. He's silent, not only wordless. He's voiceless. He is a mute being. He is as quiet, what shall I say, as the placid lake on a quiet spring day. What is responsible for the dumbness and muteness of the slave, of the bondman? What is responsible? After all, the human being. I believe that responsible for it is the lack of a basic experience, namely the experience of suffering or the experience of distress, which is perhaps the most central aspect of the human eye awareness. You know, Manita, you know, the car defined man is famous. The car defined man, Cartesius, the car. Who is man? What is man? So the car answered, man is a thinker. Cogito ergo sum, is all saying by the car. I think, most probably I do exist. Of course, it's still doubtful, but I do exist. I would say Judaism's opinion of man is, and don't say it is a pessimistic approach, it's not pessimistic at all. I would say it in Latin, dolorem ferre, or pati, I suffer, ergo sum, I do exist. The experience of suffering is an integral part of the human eye consciousness, of the human awareness. And I'll tell you my definition is superior to the cards. I'm not so vague. I'll tell you why. Because the card definition applies to the devil too. Mephisto is an excellent thinker. So Mephisto can also say, cogito ergo sum. But my definition, dolorem ferre, or pati, ergo sum, is not applicable to the devil. The devil doesn't suffer. Only genuine human being suffers. The slave lacks that experience of dolorem ferre or pati ergo sum. At this juncture, let me introduce something very elementary. It's almost borders on the vulgar, but I have to introduce it. I can't help myself. The distinction between two phenomena to which man is exposed. Namely, pain and suffering. In Hebrew it would be machov or cave and seilel. Pain is a natural sensation. It's basically physiological reaction on the part of the organism to any kind of abnormality, particularly to any kind of tissue pathology. It is, as Aristotle of old knew, he was a physician himself, a naturalist, a physician. He said that pain is the mechanical signal which man receives whenever his physical existence is menaced or threatened from within. It is, so to say, an integral part of the security system of the body. And apparently the security system of the body is by far superior to the security system at the White House. This instinctual reaction is, as it is self-evident, immediate and non-reflective. And it is not restricted to humans. The beast in the field, the brute in the woods, is also exposed to and acquainted with pain. In contrast to pain, suffering is not a sensation, not at all, but an experience. Suffering basically is a spiritual reality, not a physiological or physical sensation, not at all. It's a spiritual reality with which only humans are, what shall I say, confronted. The animal has pain, yes, does not suffer. This spiritual reality is usually encountered by man whenever he stands in danger to lose the sense either of his existential security, as it is in the case of an incurable disease, because Rahmanul Islam, if one is incurably ill, it's not only a question of pain. Pain, you have painkillers now. More or less, medicine knows how to control pain. That's a problem of suffering. Medicine cannot control suffering. Or then he stands to lose his existential dignity, as it is in the case of public humiliation. If a person is publicly humiliated, he suffers. But he lost something, of his human awareness, the aspect of dignity. When he's incurably ill, he suffers. Not only is he exposed to pain, he again is losing something. What does he stand to lose? The existential awareness. Whenever a merciless indifference, sometimes cruel, sense reality clashes with the human need awareness, man suffers and finds himself in distress. The slave is certainly exposed to pain. So is the animal, as we said before. When the slave meets with pain, he reacts like the brute does, with uttering a sharp and shrill sound. He also reacts, and he utters a sharp and shrill sound. However, I'll just call it a howl. The howl of the beast, as well as the shriek of the slave, lasts just a split second. And it dies suddenly in the darkness and in the hush of the night. In a split second, all is silent again. There is no aftermath to pain sensation, to the pain sensation of the slave. There is no follow-up. There is no complaint. There is no request. There is no protest. There's no question why and what. The agonizing howl is heard for an infinitesimal period, and it is solely due to the convulsive reflexes of the body. The slave does not know suffering, since he lacks the very need awareness which generates suffering. If it clashes with an indifferent everyday reality, he is never in distress because he has no human needs. Emphasis upon human, upon the adjective. He has no human needs. The needs of a slave are like a shriek, not human. The etiology of his needs is exclusively biological, not human. Former inmates of the concentration camps, and I spoke with many, told me that with the passage of time, they got used to everything. Nothing disturbed them, nothing surprised them anymore. They were totally anesthetized against suffering. Even the sharpness of pain was considered ridiculous. The slave is silent. He does not cry in a human fashion. He certainly does not speak up. He emits, of course, he emits a shriek, but not a human sound. Certainly, you don't hear him pronounce a word. I'm interested, I am by nature, I'm not a philosopher, but I'm a pretty good married. I have a sense for homiletics. And to me, a thought, no matter how well defined, is incomplete, as long as I don't have a midrash or an agadot to support, to back it up. Let me introduce a Zohar, a beautiful Zohar. But it's more than I would say it's more than homiletics. The Zohar gives a, projects here a beautiful picture of the slave, of the silent slave. I will read it. I have the text in Aramaic, but you permit me to read it in English straight. Moses possessed the voice. However, his speech was in bondage. You know the story Moshe told the Almighty, that he has uncircumcised lips, he's a stutterer, so they are interpreted symbolically. Not it was physically, his lips were physically uncircumcised, but spiritually he could not speak, because his speech was in bondage. It's a literal translation of the Miladelei Havi Begaluta. He was in bondage, and he could not pronounce the words. His lips were uncircumcised. That's why he refused to go to Pharaoh. The lips were enslaved. I cannot, Moses said, utter sounds. Moses said, utter sounds, but not words. Before Moses came, and the Zohar continues to tell us a very strange story. Before Moses came, not only speech, but even sound was not present. With Moses' appearance, the voice was found or was restored. Yet, it was a wordless sound. The word was still in exile. Only when the people with Moses came to the Mount Sinai and the law was given, the word was rediscovered and was united with the voice. And the word was spoken. Interesting is that the Zohar here speaks of three phases within the process of Geulah, of redemption. First phase, the stage of total silence. This means total slavery, total bondage. Second, that of sound, but not of speech. Third, that of total speech, clear, unequivocal speech. The first one, total silence, characterizes slavery. The last one, clear speech, full redemption. The middle one, when the person begins to move from the silent, mute periphery toward the center of speech, the process of Geulah sets in, and man is on his way to complete redemption. Before Moses came, there was not even a voice. No sound was heard. No complaint was lodged or registered. No sigh, no cry was uttered. Just an agonizing, inhuman shriek used to penetrate the hush or the weird silence of a otherwise quiet night. The slaves were silent, they were gloomy, but voiceless. The women did not cry, did not protest, did not fight, did not put up resistance. When the infants were snatched away from their arms and drowned in the Nile, the men kept quiet. When they were mercilessly tortured by the slave drivers. Yes, they felt pain, but they did not suffer. They took torture for granted. They thought this is the way it should be. They had no needs. They lacked one awareness, the need awareness, the awareness of dolor emergere, ergo sum. Moses, by his defending the helpless Jew, was beaten by the Egyptian slave driver, restored sensitivity to the Dow slaves, to the poor Hebrews. They suddenly realized, in a flash, in a split second, they realized that all that pain which they took for granted hundreds of years, we don't know exactly how many years they spent in Egypt, but they took pain for granted hundreds of years, all that pain, all that anguish, all that humiliation and endless torture are unwarranted. They realized suddenly, unjustified, uncalled for, that all the cruelty, greed, and intolerance of men vis-à-vis his fellow man is evil, human madness. They suddenly became perplexed, confused. They were not confused before, because they understood everything. That's what they thought. They took it for granted. They didn't protest against reality. Reality cannot be changed. But suddenly, they became perplexed, confused. And in this confusion and perplexity, usually suffering comes, anguish comes. Suddenly, they began to protest. The story of the Russian Jewry is exactly, beautifully portrayed by that there. We'll find the same phases in the process of redemption of Russian Jews. As the Zohar describes concerning our ancestors in Egypt. Suddenly the question arose, a wordless question yet, a wordless demand for justice and attribution, for change, etc. In short, the silence was done. Moses brought to the Jews the voice. And the voice means the awakening of, what shall I say, of an emotional awareness of need, or the consciousness of dolor and ferre, of pity. And I don't understand why I'm supposed to suffer. Suddenly, the existence of the poor Hebrews in Egypt became not a speaking one, but a vocal existence. They engaged in noise making, in emitting sounds. It's a vocal existence. The voice was restored there. And interesting is how the Bible tells us, Vayu bayomim rabim ro'im, vayomas melech mitzrayim, vayochud mi Yisroel min avedo, vayizoku vatal shavosom, velekim min avedo, and it came to pass in the course of the many days that the king of Egypt died, and the children of Israel sighed by reason of the bondage, and they cried, and their cry came up unto God. So there's a very simple question. This happened after Moses' appearance in Egypt. What happened before he appeared in Egypt? Why didn't they cry before the Moses episode took place? Why were they silent during the hundreds of years that they spent in slave camps prior to Moses' appearance? Apparently, their pre-Mosaic existence was a mute and silent one. They lacked the basic need awareness. They experienced no need. If you have no need, you don't know the secret that freedom is indispensable. And that freedom is the greatest of human needs. Hence, they were in no conflict with reality. And that conflict with reality between the human need and reality generates suffering and distress. The voice is restored to man at the very instant his emotional need awareness awakens. The very instant he becomes sensitive to human pain, not just pain, I'm saying the human pain. However, speech comes later, appears much later, with the birth not of the awareness of need, but with the birth of the logos of need. There is not only awareness of me. I feel, I have a desire, I have an urge. I am driven to obtain something. Not only that, this is, I would say, an emotional awareness of me. It's very important, it's the basis. But apart from the emotional awareness of me, there is a logos of me. I understand why, I want to understand why I need it. What is the purpose? And how can I get it? When I become aware of my needs, so I am already, I get my voice is restored. But the word is given to me, and I become not only aware of my need, but I begin to understand my need. Not only understand my need, I understand also the method in which I could gratify that need. Speech, however, appears much later, with the birth of the logos of the need, or with the emergence of a cognitive, value-oriented, or may I use the term, axiological need awareness. There is an emotional need awareness, which is not as yet value-oriented. There is a need awareness if one is addicted to drugs, it's also need awareness. If I'm addicted to alcohol, it's a need awareness. It's a very strong awareness. It's powerful. You know that. It may destroy a man. But what is the addict? Lacking? What is lacking? Not the need awareness. He's lacking the logos of need. Or the relationship of an emotional need awareness to a value-oriented cognitive awareness. This is the logos of need. And interesting is that the Zohar says Moses was the voice, but he had no words. Even the great Moses, who was moving from the silent periphery to the great center, did not arrive at his destination before he and his people reached Mount Sinai. For while he was need conscious, when he was the first one to emit a human sound of protest, of non-reconciliation of the human being with reality, no matter how powerful reality is, he actually emitted the first meaningful cry. He did not as yet discover the logos of need, which should have bestowed upon him the word. Yes, he felt that the situation was abnormal and the change was inevitable. However, he did not know what to do in order to liberate the people from the clutches of a monstrous reality. He experienced intuitively shame and disgrace of such a mute existence. His need awareness was extremely sensitive, yet he failed to formulate his feelings in clear, unequivocal words. He lacked the logos of need, even though he had awareness of need. The word was missing. Moses protested. He killed the tyrant. He rebuked the wicked Jew, etc. Nevertheless, he did not believe that those slaves will ever be liberated. He didn't believe in it. You know, God had an argument with him. According to Midrashic interpretation, a full week God spent arguing with Moses to convince him that those slaves, insensitive slaves, that took everything for granted, are worthy of liberation. And those slaves will turn into a great Mamlechet Kenim, into a kingdom of priests. The whole situation was bewildering. Yes, Moses broke the silence. He began to move toward the living, speaking center. However, the word was still missing. The logos of need was not revealed to Moses. And that revelation took place, you know when, Moses reached Mount Sinai. Then he understood the meaning of liberation, and he also understood his people, that his people are a very funny group. They can rise from, what shall I say, from a silent existence to an existence full of sound and song and speech within 7 weeks. They can fall into a bottomless abyss quickly, but they can rise to the stars suddenly. That Moses understood at Mount Sinai. And then the word was bestowed upon him, the greatest gift that God bestows upon man. Now let me continue, if you're not tired to listen. Slavery is not only a political juridic institution. It's not only political juridic reality. It's more than that. It is even more than a psychological reality. Slavery or bondage is an existential reality. I would say a modus existentiae. It's a way of life. You ask me, you would ask me, if you wanted to interrupt me, how does existential slavery express itself? We know how juridic, economic, political slavery expresses itself. You know that. But how does existential slavery demonstrate itself, manifest itself? How, what is it? What kind of an existence is it? I'll answer you immediately. In a peripheral existence. In a peripheral existence. If a person leads a peripheral existence, he is a slave, existentially. I'll tell you, I'm a rabbi, as Dr. Levin told, I'm a rov. Regretfully, there was a secular Jewish writer who described the existential slave in a beautiful manner. I could have picked another quotations from other writers, but I believe he did it in a magnificent fashion. This is Peretz. You all know the story of Don Cheshvite. Many of you know. I don't know how many know. If I were in my class, I would tell you, raise your hands. Well, not those who know, those who don't know. Yeah. But there is just at the beginning. The whole story I don't like. It's too sarcastic. It's even cynical. However, the description of Don Cheshvite, the name itself Shvite means silent. Silence is beautiful. Shall I read it at the beginning in Yiddish, or you want me to give the translation? Yiddish beginning. Peretz starts with the following paragraph. Do ich der Welt, wat bonche Schweig steht, gar keinen einzigen Eindruck gemacht. Fragt ihn jetzt in Becheren, wer bonche Schweig ist gewesen. Bonche hat still gelebt und still gestorben. Wie erschrocken ist er durchgegangen durch unsere Welt. Durch Bonches Bries hat man kein Wein nicht getrunken. Es haben kein Käses nicht geklungen. Zu Bar Mitzwe hat er kein Klingen, die Gedrosche nicht gesorgt. Gelebt hat er wie ein groß, klein Kerndl Samt beim Brett von Jahren, zwischen Millionen seinesgleichen. Als der Wind hat es aufgeheben, und auf der anderen Seite rübergeworfen, hat das keiner nicht bemerkt. No. It's my translation, wenn Sie sagen. Mein Paul finds with me in that respect. Bonche Schweig's death made no impression whatsoever. No one knew who Bonche was. Bonche lived mutely and died quietly. Like a silent shadow, did he pass through our world. At Bonche's circumcision, no toes were raised, no glasses were clinked. At Bar Mitzvah, no rousing speech was delivered. He lived in anonymity, like a gray, minute grain of sand on the beach of a stormy sea, among millions of identical sand particles. No one noticed that one of the particles was picked up by the storm wind and carried far, far away. very dirty. They are slaves, not in a juridic fashion, but in the existential sense. They are faceless, they are nameless. No one is interested in them. No one is concerned with or about them. No one rejoices in their presence, and no one bemoans their absence. They come and go like Peretz's Bonchesvai, without leaving a trace, without making a mark. They are forgotten people. The cemeteries are full of them. The death notice on the obituary page in a paper, if such a notice did appear, or the inscription on the tombstone, is the only reminder that somebody existed somewhere, some time ago. Those people lack, like the slave of antiquity, a need awareness. They know not what suffering is. They are therefore speechless. They are even voiceless. Man was endowed with voice and speech in order to react. God gave him speech and voice in order to react in a human fashion to suffering, in order to be able to define and articulate his needs. With the disappearance of a need awareness, one forfeits voice and speech as well. But let me add something. We have been speaking about some people, like Bonchesvai, who lead a peripheral silent existence. This is not true. Judaic, may I use this term, Judaic existentialism, because the oldest book on existentialism is not Pascal or Augustine, but Attilin. This is the oldest book on existentialism. To attribute existentialism to Augustine or to Pascal or to Kierkegaard simply is plagiarism. We all plagiarized Attilin. Judaic existentialism has gone a step further. It has frankly stated that not some of the people lead a silent or peripheral existence. They are bondmen slaves. This is true, but it's not the full truth. Judaism has frankly stated that all the people are existentially peripheral, mute beings, fringe dwellers. No matter how vocal, and no matter how energetic they are. When the Ecclesiast said, Ki b'choshech ba, u'b'choshech yelech, u'b'choshech shmo yechuseh, for it comes in vanity, in the parts in darkness, and the name thereof is covered with darkness. He did not refer only to the timid soul, to the poor and meek, the Bonchesvai, but to everybody, to the great ruler, to the daring warrior, to the captain of industry, and to the famous orator. No matter how prestigious an existence he lived in his terms, he lives on the outskirts of being. We have developed before the equation of silence and the absence of a need awareness. Judaism holds the view that no individual has a right to boast that he possesses the right sensitivity to and knowledge of his needs. Not even the most sophisticated and the most enlightened person is familiar with his genuine needs. In fact, man is totally ignorant, even of his most cardinal needs, urges and desires. And here comes in a very strange philosophical doctrine which plays an important role in Judaism. The double image doctrine, which plays such a significant role in our philosophy of sinner repentance, lies at the very root of our pessimistic appraisal of man's relationship to his own needs. Sin in Judaism, what I mean by the double image theory is as follows. Sin in Judaism, in contradistinction to Christian theology since Augustine, is not within man, but extraneous to man. It's something foreign to man. The cause of sin is to be found not in man, not in genuine man, but in the identification of man with the wrong image, with a phony, if I may use this term, colloquial, with a phony eye awareness. If man identifies himself with a pseudo, with the pseudo eye, with a phony eye awareness, then that identification breeds sin. What is repentance according to Judaism? My mind is formulated in one sentence. Repentance is the consequence of rediscovery of the genuine I, of the genuine image. And sin means the wrong identification. Now let us draw a very simple conclusion. If man has a tendency to identify himself with the wrong I personality, then he is also want to respond to the needs of that personality. We are very ambitious. As a matter of fact, modern man has countless needs, but they don't belong to him. They are needs of somebody else. In a word, not only some people live on the periphery, but all of us. Man with the wrong table of needs is not a full being. And at this point, another Judaic doctrine comes to the fore, namely the activist doctrine. Activist now is a very fashionable word among the Russian Jews. They call them those who stand up and speak are called activists. But it is a Judaic activist doctrine of self-redemption. What does this doctrine say? Maimonides, in my opinion, I don't know whether some historians will agree with me or not. In my opinion, this is the central doctrine in Maimonides' Meir Nebuchim. It comes to expression, unfortunately, not in this first part, and not in the middle part, but in the last part. Usually historians forget about the last part. The story is about the Alshech, you know, a Jew said that he became a heretic and a Apikeres because of the Alshech. Because the Alshech has the habit of formulating many 20, 25 questions. And then he begins to resolve the questions. But the Shabbos, the Jew was tired after meal. So the questions he did read. But the answers, by the time he was supposed to read the answers, he was asleep, sound asleep. So after a certain period of time, he found himself full of questions without answers. This is the trouble with my mind, is that actually this theory was expounded by my mind in the third section of the Meir Nebuchim. What does this theory say? I believe this doctrine says as follows. Man comes into our world as a hyletic. I mean, I'm using the Aristotelian jargon, but I don't have a better word for that. It means what we call in our traditional medieval philosophical jargon, chemera iulia, means some people heard of it. Chemera iulia means there is potency, but there is no actuality. It's called hyle in Greek. He comes as a hyletic, amorphous being. He is created, of course, in the image of God. However, this image is a challenge, is an idea. Or I would rather say it's an ideal. It's a twinkling star on a far horizon. It is not a grant, a gratuitous grant, that God gives man the divine image just for the asking. It is up to man to take an ideal and translate into a reality, to reach out for the twinkling star, no matter how distant man is from that star. It's up to man to objectify himself, to impress for him upon a latent, formless, even though a divine personality, and to move from the hyletic, silent periphery to the center of objective, formed reality. This is basically the ideal upon Maimonides. I don't have to tell you that. The ideal of education. The highest norm in Maimonidean moral code is, what a strange, what would you say? What would you say? What would you say? I mean, knowing Maimonides, what does he consider the highest moral norm? A very short norm. To be, to exist. And Maimonides did not have Hamlet doubts whether to be or not to be. If it is to be, it means play, to exist. But to exist in Maimonides means to draw out of myself the genuine I, who is sometimes hidden in the distant recesses of my personality. To be in a total sense, to liberate oneself from the bondage of a shadowy, and I use now also a Platonic term because it says something which I cannot translate. Plato spoke of meon, on means being, reality. Meon means non-reality, half-reality, semi-reality. It's a chaotic state. I mean, man does exist, but not fully. From the shadows of meon, and make men move toward the white spaces that Plato calls ontoson, real being, genuine being, full being, total being. In the world of ontoson, there is speech, there is sound, there is color, there is song. In the world of meon, I mean, you know Plato's realm of ideas and the realm of sensible things. In the world of meon, the world of man is full of shadows. And what is education for my mind is to take men out of this city, basically emigration. The Russians don't like it, but absolutely. To take men out of the realm of shadows and place them in the realm of light. Or from the realm of, take him out of the realm of silence, muteness, and place him in the realm of speech and the clear word. How is it being done? How could we achieve this objectification of the human being? How? All right, it's a beautiful idea. To be in a total sense. But how? Judaism recommended two acts of redemption. Trying to guess? One through knowledge means, in our vocabulary, it means through Torah. The redemption of the intellect, or objectification, redemption of the intellect through knowledge, through cognition, through Torah. Second, through tefillah. The redemption, of course, Torah redeems the intellect. What does tefillah redeem? The need awareness. The awareness of dolorem ferre, or pati, ergosum. It's important in Judaism. It's the basic awareness of the human being. With your permission, I'll just explain in a few sentences How does the process of intellectual objectification, how does it function? And it will facilitate my task of explaining to you how the objectification via feeling occurs. We all know the story that is related to Nida Daflamet 30, comma, I mean, 2B, yes, 30B, I mean, if someone wants to check, I mean, I have it, I cut it out. I have it right here, but I'll give my own translation. It's much better than the official, the standard translation. But if somebody should doubt my word and say, I mean, it's my own story, I made it up, so I have it. Right. We all know the story told in Pratit Nida about the angel who teaches Torah, the whole Torah from beginning to end, to the embryo or fetus. During the 9 months of incubation, the greatest color is the embryo. And who strikes the baby upon its face, upon its mouth, immediately before the baby is ready to see light, means to be born, before birth. And the end, the same angel who taught the baby the whole system of law, the whole Torah from beginning to end, makes it forget everything. Of course, when the baby comes into this world, you know very well, it doesn't know too much. As a matter of fact, this story, it actually was translated into a certain custom. The reason why people visit the baby or the mother on the Shabbat before the bris is the tragedy which happened to the baby. It's basically a condolence visit we pay to the baby. But the baby is in mourning. It was such a great scholar, and there was no need to pay tuition and to look for admission to some Ivy League college. And suddenly it has forgotten everything. Jews are very, you know, very sympathetic, merciful. They pay a condolence visit. I'm mocking the Nachem Chor. God should comfort. That's what Atas says. The question, I believe, the question is obvious. If the angel makes the baby forget everything he taught it, so then why did he bother to teach the embryo at all? It's a waste of time. The answer, I believe, is again obvious and clear. And when a Jew studies Torah, he is confronted with something which is not foreign to him, not superimposed upon him from the outside. He is confronted with something which is not extraneous to him, but to be something which is intimate and known from before. He knew all that once upon a time. It was stored up in the recesses of his memory. Of course, he studies his own stuff by sheer association, you know very well, by sheer association, we are reminded of the Platonic doctrine that learning is recalling, recollection, the same doctrine. What does it mean? Learning means recalling of something, recollecting of something familiar. The Jew studying Torah acts like the amnesia victim who is trying hard to reconstruct out of the debris of his memory a beautiful world which intuitively he knows, he can prove it, he enjoyed it once upon a time. In other words, by learning Torah, the Jew expands his own self. To study means to objectify and to redeem oneself from the eidetic, from the silent existence. By studying, a Jew heads straight toward the charted, illuminated, and speaking existence. But everything is within him. He draws it out of himself. Education as drawing out of oneself. That's exactly what Rabbi Simloy, the name of the rabbi who told this story, is Rabbi Simloy. Rabbi Simloy wanted to convey to us. Now, I'm just in short, I want to say, intellectual redemption of study, which is achieved through study, Torah, was also, I mean, the three phases which the Zohar mentioned vis-a-vis our parents, our, excuse me, ancestors in Egypt. First of all, the first stage, we encounter silence, complete intellectual insensitivity, and total unconcern. You may meet people, the people not only they are not educated somehow, it's not a question, they didn't have the opportunity, but they are totally unconcerned. They don't possess this curiosity or what Aristotle called the amazement, the why or what that man willy-nilly utters when he is confronted by the cosmos, by the universe. They lack it. Silence. There is no awareness of me. That you start with every baby like that. Unfortunately, some people grow up with this awareness. That world, during that period of time, the man is unconcerned, completely unconcerned. He's not amazed, takes everything for granted. He simply doesn't react to the beauty of the universe. After all, God has showered so much beauty upon this universe. Nor does he react to the intellectual aspect, to the scientific question, why, what, how. This is Hilei, complete potentiality, but no actuality. It is the world of shadows. It is the world of silence. Then comes the second phase. As a teacher, I know that the second phase is not the word. The word is the idea, the voice. Which means the pupil, somehow the pupil's voice was restored. Or the voice is restored to man, it means you hear sounds but not words. The awakening, it characterizes the awakening of cognitive curiosity and amazement. Man begins to be annoyed because he does not understand. He is troubled by something he himself cannot define. And that is the beginning of knowledge. This is the voice. This is transitional stage. Of course, at the end, at the conclusion, comes the word. The word breaks through. What is the word in the intellectual world, in the academic world? Clear and distinct cognition. The intellect begins to speak. And at that moment, the intellect begins to speak, to ask and to answer. It's more important than the intellect asks the question. There's not always an answer. There are no answers to all questions. But begins to speak in the clear accents of the Logos. Then man finds himself objectified, redeemed, and a citizen, not of Neon, but of Ontoson. Now let us ask, how does man redeem himself through prayer? That's actually my topic. Judaism, in contradistinction to mystical quietism, and it's usually non-Jewish mysticism. The Jewish mystics will have a different approach. But non-Jewish mysticism, throughout the ages, recommended toleration of pain. Judaism in contradistinction to that doctrine, who wants men, as I said already before, to cry out aloud against any kind of pain. To react, Judaism rejected Stoicism. Some people are Stoics. Maimonides himself was a Stoic. They couldn't help. It was a part of him. But Judaism as a whole, the halacha, is opposed to Stoicism, to taking pain quietly, graciously, with magnanimity. He wants men to react indignantly to all kinds of injustice or unfairness. For Judaism holds the view that the individual who displays immunity to pain and suffering, who meekly reconciles himself to the ugly, disproportionate, and unjust in life, who does not shudder at the sight of the Satan, the individual who has no needs at all, whose needs are a few and easily gratified, that individual will never be able to appreciate beauty and goodness, and particularly to share in the travail and the suffering of others. Whoever permits his legitimate needs to go unsatisfied will never be sympathetic to the crying needs of others. Human morality, which is based on love and friendship and sharing in the travail of others, cannot be practiced if the person's own needs awareness is dull and meek. If the individual himself knows not what suffering is, then he'll never share in the suffering of others. Hence, Judaism rejected what kind of an existence? Ascetic, yeah, but I have a better term. The angelic existence. You all know that, Dada. The angels appeared before the Almighty and said, they want the Torah. Why the Torah be given to sinful man, frail man, weak man, mortal man? Why not be given to the angels, to the archangels, who live forever? What did God answer? I give the Torah to people with needs. Angels live in existence without need, and the Torah does not belong to them. Therefore, prayer in Judaism is again, unlike prayer in the mystical literature, bound up with human needs, human drives, human urges, and human wants. Out of the 19 benedictions in our Shemoneh Esrei, now Tfilat Amidah, 13 are concerned exclusively with human need. Kama tochenil adam dat until shomea tefillah. And even two of the last three benedictions, Reitzei and Sim Shalom, are again concerned with need and their nature, and they display petitional, so to say, nature, the petitional benediction. Judaism was not too excited over hymnal prayer or thanksgiving prayer. We know we have that. We have that. We recite the Hallel on certain occasions. We recite Psukei Zimri every morning prior to the recital of the benedictions of Kriyat Shema. Correct. The Book of Psalms is replete with hymn, beautiful, magnificent hymn, exalted hymn. But the hymn is not the very essence of the Jewish prayer. And the Jewish prayer, the very essence, the very substance of the Jewish prayer, is petition intercession, asking, requesting, and sometimes demanding from the Almighty. It's very strange. Christians don't understand it. They're having trouble with the Paternoster, in the Lord's Prayer, to give us our daily bread, they have trouble. We ask more than bread. We ask luxury sometimes. And that's exactly what Judaism wants us to do. The person in need is summoned to pray. And halachically, I could prove it to you, but I have no time for that. Prayer and tzorah. You know what tzorah is, I mean. Either you say it in Sephardic dialect or in Ashkenazi dialect. It's the same tzorah. prayer is inseparably linked up, bound up with sorrow. Who prays? Who is in distress? Minameitza Torosiko, out of the narrow straits, I invoke God. Mimamakim Torosiko Adishem, I invoke God, de profundis, from the depth in which I find myself. V'chisove milchomo be'artzaches, then war will be declared. Then pray. And this is true according to Maimonides as well. And Nachmanides, who dealt with the problem of prayer from a halachic viewpoint, prayer and need are inseparably bound up. If man does not experience minameitza, narrowness, existential narrowness, if man is not in distress, minameitzar, if he is not somewhere in subterranean depth, if he feels happy and contented, there is halachically no need for prayer. Don't have to join the temple or a synagogue. You can save a few dollars. If man is happy, contented, prayer not only is not necessary, but it's an absurdity. Prayer is the result of this consciousness, of a permanent crisis consciousness, the consciousness of dolorem terrae, ergo sum. This is prayer. Of course, with the awakening of the need awareness, prayer is dependent upon the need awareness. If a man has a need awareness, then pray, ask, demand, request. If you have no need awareness, either your needs are few or you think you have gratified all your needs, then there is no need for prayer. With the awakening of the need awareness, prayer makes its entry. Prayer at this stage, and I would ask for your attention, at this stage is called Seoko, Tzadik Ayin Kuf Hei. Seoko, not Fila yet. Not Fila yet. Fila is a higher, I'll explain what Fila is. Seoko, Tzadik Ayin Kuf Hei. What does Seoko mean anymore? Shriek, outcry. And one of the attributes of the Almighty is Shomea called Seoko. He hearkens to the voice, to the cry, to the shriek, to the howl. He hearkens to it. Not words, chaos. You don't say Shemaya called Tfilah, you don't say. Because when God hearkens to Tfilah, then he hearkens to words. But when it is about Tzorpa, there are no words yet. Man hasn't discovered the logos of me. He just discovered the awareness of me, that he is a being in need. He is dependent. And that the consummation of the ideal of man, of his life, I mean, the meaningfulness, can only be obtained from somewhere else, not from within. Then there is, prayer is indispensable. But this is the logos. But for the time being, it is just so awkward, just a clown cry. There is as yet no word, no sentence, even though the emotional awareness has awakened. The logos of need is still dormant, silent. There is as yet no clear understanding what one is crying for. There is, however, distress and loud human weeping. Seoko is primordial prayer. The voice is restored. The word is still missing. He prays because he's in narrow straits. He prays because he is in the depth. But for what he prays, he doesn't know. Did our ancestors in Egypt know when they began to pray? For what? Pray was an expression of protest against reality, against the present. But what, how it should be changed, what man wants, at this stage, he doesn't know as yet. Interesting is, I mean, just it is a parenthetical statement, that the service of Slichot, I mean, the original service of Slichot, is actually represents not Philo, but Tzohar. Short sentences. Om Adishem, Ishiyono, Aneinu, Aneinu, Aneinu. Just you repeat one word. Aneinu, answer, hearken, Aneinu, Aneinu, Aneinu. Later it was elaborated, of course, transformed into literary creations, but in the beginning it was just an outcry, a shriek, a word whose meaning, I mean, the worshipper did not understand. Aneinu. Mishana la Avraham Avinu la Avraham. Aneinu. Apparently the Shliach Tzibur, the cantor, used to say the sentence, the crowd couldn't read. They didn't know how to formulate the prayer. They just answered in monosyllables, or just with one word, Aneinu, Ishano, Ishano, Ishano. This is the stage of Tzohar. The need awareness has awakened. Man feels the reality has to be corrected, changed. Man registers protest against reality, but he doesn't know what the substitute is. This is so hard. Let us continue. Now we come to Tfilah. Let us continue with our analysis. There is an inner contradiction within the need awareness. I know my own opinion, I mean, I've spoken so much about it, I mentioned it in my essay. The awareness of need is a dialectical awareness, basically. It means it has an inner contradiction. On the one hand, it urges man, as I stated before, to gratify his needs and warns him against any attempt to suppress them, since non-gratification is contrary to human dignity. You see, the first aspect of the awareness of need is not only just that I am in need, a statement of fact, but there is a normative element, a normative aspect. Gratify, try to gratify your needs. Don't suppress them. Because suppression of needs and the denial of gratification to needs is contrary to the divine scheme of creation and to dignity of man. However, there's another aspect in the awareness of need. It also warns men against total gratification of his needs. Some needs, and to our chagrin, the most pressing ones, must and will never be gratified. That's what Judaism said. The awareness of need is of a dialectical nature. It has an inner contradiction. There are two aspects which are mutually exclusive. One aspect is gratify your need. Gratification is incumbent upon man. It is incumbent upon man to gratify his needs. If man tries to suppress his needs, like monastic philosophy or asceticism, I mean, would recommend, then he's actually, lowering his dignity. On the other hand, there's another aspect. Total gratification? To become an addict? To become a voluptuary? To gratify every need and totally gratify? Forbidden, it's forbidden. You shouldn't do that. Some needs deserve to be gratified. Some needs should be suppressed, or rather excluded from the human need awareness. Suppression is a word that Judaism did not like. The need awareness tells man that total gratification will in the long run, could in the long run, destroy man's dignity and man's humanity. What should man do in such a case? What should he do? He's caught in the crucible of contradiction. What advice should he follow? Advice number one, gratification of needs is a human performance. A man will enhance his dignity by gratifying his needs, or should he listen, pay attention to the advice to just the reverse? Namely, total gratification of needs is forbidden. You lose your human dignity if you succumb to needs. Of course, Judaism comes forward with a complete axiological doctrine of human needs. It tries to teach men which need should and which should not be gratified. This is basically the essence of halacha. You ask me what halacha is recommending man, the modus operandi, how man should relate himself to the both aspects of the need awareness, to the aspect which recommends gratification, and to the aspect which tells him total gratification is insane, means destruction of the personality. There are criteria by which one may be guided in his attempt to treat his needs, his need awareness, on its selective basis. The halachic prayer, it's hard for me now, my time is almost up. You don't know how much time I allocated to myself, huh? I didn't ask you on it. Yeah, but it's... All right, yes. So I could prove it to you, by studying each bracha separately. So the brachas, those benedictions, contain not only the fact that that man is in need, but also a scale, a hierarchy of needs. Instructs men to distinguish between worthwhile, constructive gratification of need and a disjunctive one. It means that in addition to the awareness of need, man must what? Must also possess the logos I mentioned before, the logos of need. Man should not only be sensitive to his needs, but also know and evaluate them as well. He's supposed to relate them to moral norms and their gratification thus ethicized. There are no neutral activities in Judaism. There is no division of sectors into mundane and sacred. Every sector in human life can either serve as a sanctuary for God or deteriorate into a madhouse of profanity and absurdity. And it's up to man to decide. And the main decision, the most important decision that man makes is concerned with the problem at need. Which needs be gratified, which eliminated and be solved by men. At this stage, and this is the Shemnesra, there is a hierarchy of needs, beginning with Atochenen and closing, concluded with Shemei Atfila. At this stage, prayer is not just a shriek, not just a cry, and not just a howl anymore. It is rather a well-defined thought, a clear conception. See, also at this stage, the man introduces the logos of need, turns into tefillah. What the exact semantics of tefillah, of the term tefillah is, we do not know. It's very hard. Not many opinions. But one thing we do know.